The fight's not over today on the world. I'm Marco Werman. A blizzard in North Dakota, but Standing Rock protesters stay put.
We celebrated that victory, and it was a small victory. I think a lot of people misunderstood until that, you know, we see action and it's confirmed. I don't think people are going to leave.
Plus, members of the Sioux tribe fight to save their language.
I've been learning for about 4 years now, but my dad's a fluent speaker, so I grew up around it. He just never taught me.
And two brothers who ignored their father's advice.
Don't get on the donkey. So of course, as two young boys might do, once they got out of their father's line of sight, they started riding the donkey.
So began the amazing journey of Philip Hitti and the start of Islamic studies in America. All that and more today on The World. Thank you for being with us on this Tuesday. If you've been watching the weather reports out of North Dakota, you know what the Standing Rock protesters have been dealing with. A blizzard blasted the area yesterday, complete with whiteout conditions and dangerously cold temperatures. This just hours after protesters there celebrated a big decision by the Army Corps of Engineers. The agency refused to allow a key section of the Dakota Access Pipeline to be drilled underneath the Missouri River. That was Sunday, then came the blizzard on Monday. The world's Jasmine Garst has been in North Dakota now for a few days. You could say she has a new appreciation for the weather there.
It is brutal. I mean, it's been a ferocious blizzard, a wind chill of about minus 20. And, you know, you have to remember, those people at Standing Rock, they're camping. And I just wanted to tell you, you know, North Dakota weather is notoriously bad, but even this is unusual for this area. We talked to a local who said the last time she can remember a storm like this is in early 2000. This is Diane Bachmeyer. She's a lifelong resident of Flasher, North Dakota, which is right outside of Standing Rock. She owns an inn here. And she's been getting more business than usual.
I had some that had run into the ditches, and then the cop brought them in. And I ended up having, my rooms were all full, so I had to put mattresses on the floor in the lobby for them.
Wow, even camping in the inn. So the Standing Rock camp itself is filled with protesters and vets from out of town. How many of them are still at the camp?
A lot. Marco, we were not able to get into the camp last night. The roads were just blocked off, but we touched base with a Nakota Nation veteran who we've been following around in the last couple of days. Her name is Brandy King. She's at the camp. She's been at the camp for months. And she says most protesters are still there. And here's why. Protesters are worried that even though this decision came down from the Army Corps that says you cannot build this under the Missouri River, there's been plenty of pushback from those who do want to build the Dakota Access Pipeline, and, you know, political pushback. And so people are just a little worried that this decision is not going to be respected. Here is Brandy.
We celebrated that victory, and it was a small victory. I think a lot of people misunderstood that, okay, that meant the pipeline was over with. So now there are several people who are basically, you know, we're not going to leave until we see those dapple security lights removed from the hills here. Until that, you know, we see action and until we, you know, it's confirmed, I don't think people are going to leave.
And I should say that Brandy has seen no cases of hypothermia, and she's very active in the camp. Actually, her job in the camp is to, quote unquote, winterize people. She's from Montana. She is Nakota. So she is very used to this weather, and her job is to make sure other people are prepared for it. So she says she's seen no cases of hypothermia. People are taking really good care of each other, but she is worried about what is coming.
Yeah. So how are folks on the ground managing?
Well, people are staying in old school buses, motorhomes, teepees, dome-like yurts, you know, these structures that are really good at containing heat. There are supplies. There's donated food. There's water being stockpiled, a collection of Army surplus tents, heating stoves. And a lot of people brought firewood from other parts of the country, too. Again, here's veteran Brandy King about her firewood situation.
Yeah, like last night I was in my truck guarding my firewood because, you know, I kind of have to protect that right now. I mean, I'm always down for sharing, but this is the time to kind of, you know, get your own firewood and, you know, if you can't, find someplace warm.
Yeah, so it sounds like a lot of tests of self-sufficiency. What about the organizers? What's being done? What are they doing to keep people safe?
I think that the big concern is protesters who are from out of town. You know, we met plenty of people from Florida, Arizona, places where you just don't get this type of weather. And so they are saying, you guys got to go, because I can imagine that they don't want a case of hypothermia on their hands.
Yeah, and for media from out of town who are trying to leave, and you know from experience, that's not easy either, is it?
Yeah, we learned the hard way last night. We got kind of lost in the blizzard, and we skidded off into a 15-car pileup. The police had to get a tow truck to winch us out, and then we had to drive in a pretty scary blizzard.
The world's Jasmine Garz, you and the team stay safe and warm out there, and thanks a lot.
I'll stay safe. I don't know about warm. Thank you.
A year ago, I hadn't heard of Standing Rock. Maybe you hadn't either. Now, of course, the pipeline protests have made Standing Rock part of our news lexicon. But for all the news coverage of the protests, we still don't really know a whole lot about the people who live within the borders of the Standing Rock Reservation or their culture. I'm joined now by Patrick Cox of our language podcast, The World in Words. And Patrick, you spent some time recently at Standing Rock to find out more about the heritage language there. So one slice of life of the Standing Rock Sioux, right?
That's right. Yeah, the language is Lakota. And it's got this really rich heritage. It's the language of Sitting Bull and Crazy Horse and Red Cloud. Mm. And you can still find it spoken not just at Standing Rock, but on several reservations in North and South Dakota. But it is in sharp decline, like so many Native American languages. At Standing Rock, though, there's been a movement to revitalize it that is gaining some momentum now. Let me introduce you to just a couple of people that we spoke to in the podcast. The first is the most unlikely of people, a guy who grew up thousands of miles away, in fact, behind the Iron Curtain in what was then Czechoslovakia.
Wow.
I lived, when I was young, I lived in a communist country.
This is a man called Jan Ulrich.
And we were not free, we were oppressed, we were oppressed by colonizing power, and we sympathized with other people who had a history of being colonized.
There was sympathy for the oppressed, yes, but not many hard facts.
This was the time before internet, and this was the time before the wall fell down, so we were pretty isolated at that time.
Jan loved languages, and he loved to figure out how they worked. He learned Russian, because he had to, and then later English. And then?
In 1986, I went to a museum in Prague, our capital, and I found the 1852 Riggs Dakota Dictionary, and that was my first contact with the language.
Dakota is closely related to Lakota. And that dictionary that Jan found, the Riggs one, it was edited by Christian missionaries. Jan read it, and he wanted to know more.
I was lucky. I had a friend who emigrated out of the country with his parents, and he was able to send me some books from the U.S. about Lakota language and Lakota culture.
And so began Jan's Lakota education. 3 years after he found the dictionary, the wall came down, and things became a lot easier, but also more complicated. The more Jan studied the old texts, the documents that first committed the Lakota language to paper, the more confused he got.
When I was able to get hold of materials from the missionaries, the dictionaries and some of the other things from the missionaries, it became obvious that those materials did not match what other authors wrote about the language, primarily a native-speaking linguist. And to me, that became a big puzzle.
So what were the missionaries saying that was so different from the native speaker?
Do you want the long story or the short story?
Yeah, so Patrick, did you get the long story or the short story?
Well, I got kind of a medium-length story. But here is the uber-short version. Jan Ulrich, he's now a professor of linguistics and a fluent speaker of Lakota. He also advises tribal elders on language reform because it got a little messed up by some of those missionaries, especially the written form of Lakota. So now there's a new alphabet that Ulrich helped introduce. It's richer, it reflects the sounds more closely. It's not universally popular with all the older native speakers, but it's really helpful, not just for preserving the language, but also for people who want to learn it.
Mm. Who's the second person you're going to introduce us to?
Well, this is Elena Eagle Shield. She's a member of the Standing Rock Sioux tribe, and her mother tongue is English. Even though her own father was a native Lakota speaker, he decided not to pass the language on to her. There were too many negative associations for him. But as an adult, she decided to learn it. So I asked her what her father thought about that.
He's happy. And once I got pregnant with my own daughter, I decided that I wasn't going to give my kids that option. I tried to decide what I could do to give them the best chance at life that I could give them. And for me, that was giving them a sense of who they truly are.
The alternative, she says, is pretty bleak.
I don't know if you've ever been around the res, but a lot of people think they're in gangs. You know, they don't know what a gang really is. They've never, maybe from TV, I don't know. There's a lot of gangs. There's a lot of jumpings, you know, where people fight. There's a lot of bickering. And to me, I feel like that is them not having a sense of identity or who they are.
When she says that, I understand why she's so determined to expose her daughter to the language, both at home and at school. It's a relatively new Lakota immersion school.
We drive 2 hours a day, and sometimes it gets tough for her. And she's like, why do I have to go to school there? You know, why this? Why that? And sometimes I get discouraged by it because it's expensive. But definitely good sacrifices in the long run. Reassuring myself, because it does get tough. And there are times I want to quit.
But she doesn't. In fact, a few weeks ago, Elena started a new project. She became the teacher at that makeshift Lakota school at the pipeline protest site. She and several others I met, they're as determined to reintroduce Lakota as so many of the previous generation were to let it go.
My dad is a direct descendant of Mary Crawler. And Mary Crawler was a woman in the Battle of Little Bighorn who went mid into the battle and saved her brother. And so she carried a name that I carry is Hochoka Kutepiwi, which means shoots at her in the center or shoots at her in the midst. And because she was never hit, like that was a powerful name for her. That was a name that was passed on to me. And so having that pride and, you know, who I am and just always being able to turn to my culture and turn to my language was really what helped me.
I don't really know where this leaves Lakota. It's not in good shape as a spoken language. Everyone agrees on that. But it's in better written shape. It's better looked after. And it's hard not to root for it when you see a bunch of people converge on Standing Rock from various parts of the U.S. and beyond for 3 weeks of intensive classes.
Wow, a new spot. Do we have a new spot?
Everybody, it's a start. I suppose you could almost call it a restart.
The language is not dead yet. You can hear more of Patrick Cox's report on the Lakota language. Listen out for how a group of elders came up this year with hundreds of new Lakota words, including ones for Velcro, socialism, and puffin. Fun fact, that last one, puffin, translates actually as clumsy bird. You can find The World in Words wherever you get your podcasts and also at pri.org/language. Still ahead, Fidel Castro and his leisure wear. That's coming up here on The World. I'm Marco Werman with The World. Germany was more welcoming than most other nations last year at the height of Europe's migrant crisis. Chancellor Angela Merkel led her country in taking in almost a million migrants in 2015. Today, though, Merkel struck a different tone. She made clear that the migrants, who are mostly Muslim, will have to integrate fully into European society. And she endorsed a proposal to ban full-face veils, like the ones worn by some Muslim women. Constanze Seltzenmuller is a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution. I asked her what's behind Merkel's comments today.
I think that is her attempt at responding to a strain of political populism in Germany that seems to have everything to do with a fear of loss of identity, a fear of Muslim immigrants or Muslim fellow citizens for that matter, because some of these women wearing the veil, and there are not more than a couple thousand from what I've seen, may very well be German citizens rather than refugees. But there is a sense in Germany of society being overwhelmed by globalization, just as there is in many other countries. And people are picking on the sort of very visible symptoms of withdrawal, as it were, from German society. And they're rightly or wrongly, and I admit that I feel uncomfortable with this, picking on the full veil.
I mean, I guess it's no coincidence that Merkel was trying to get her party's endorsement to run for a fourth term as chancellor, and she succeeded, right? But how far to the right do you think Angela Merkel will allow herself to go?
I think she made it very clear in her speech today at the party conference that elected her party leader for the ninth time that she was not going to succumb to some of the most harsh demands of the conservative fringe. She has so far successfully refused to set upper limits for refugee intake of Germany. She is continuing to say, you know, we have to accept reality as it is. We can't escape it. And this is something that she actually said in her speech to the party Congress, that she could not promise that things would become less difficult because times were difficult and we will have to deal with that. Which is, I think, saying to people, you know, we can't select our reality. We can't bake our own reality. These are the facts, and we can't just close off our borders. That's untenable. That's not even doable. So we're going to have to deal with these problems as they arise.
I'm just curious, how does the hostility to newcomers, especially Muslim newcomers in Germany, play out there?
It's played out in an increase of violence against refugees and refugee housing.
And who perpetrates that violence? Is it kind of groups that you would say are neo-Nazis, or do we know?
I'm not sure that we know all that much about it. I suspect the hardcore are what you would call neo-Nazis. I think there is probably a larger circle of people who don't follow a defined ideology, but for whom refugees are the physical representation of something that they fear. In other words, the loss of control, the loss of borders, globalization, and they are looking for a scapegoat, somebody to blame. I mean, this is obviously deplorable, and it's something that the police in Germany have had a tough time to getting to grips with. But it's unfortunately an ongoing phenomenon. That said, I think it's important to remind people that a great deal of very positive work is going on here in integrating refugees. I mean, I follow the German news very carefully, and there are many successful stories of local communities still being very welcoming and refugees successfully finding jobs and settling down. I think it's probably fair to say that the anger and concern that there is in Germany is disproportionate to the actual size of the problem.
Constanze Seltzenmuller, senior fellow at Brookings, thank you very much.
Pleasure.
The classic image we have of the late Fidel Castro is that of a bearded man in an olive drab uniform, the same uniform that the rest of the Cuban military wears. Nothing special, but at some point in the last dozen years or so, that changed to tracksuits. Castro seemed to favor Adidas especially. We've been wondering if there are any fashion lessons or political lessons to take away from this. My colleague Emilio San Pedro joins us from Miami. So when and why did Fidel grow out of wearing his military fatigues and switch to this sports warm-up gear?
So the first one I can remember was right after he had had that operation for a problem that was treated as a state secret, but which we think had something to do with intestinal surgery. At that time, he was visited by Hugo Chavez in hospital. And that was the first time we saw him wearing a tracksuit. And then over a period of years, every time we tended to see Fidel Castro greeting people or meeting heads of state, he tended to be in that tracksuit or in one of those tracksuits. Some of them had the Cuban national sports team's emblem, and he was like one of the athletes. F. Castro, it would say.
You know, Cuba is all about propaganda. I mean, you don't want to say, I'm retired and the revolution is over. So how does an Adidas tracksuit convey still the power of revolutionary garb?
Because it is slightly revolutionary to wear a tracksuit to greet, big major dignitaries, including the Pope. You know, it is rather irreverent. And I think a tracksuit gave him, to a certain degree, a bit of man of action flavor he would have not had had he been in what somebody might be wearing in a nursing home, let's say.
Okay, I buy that. It is an irony, though, don't you admit, that after years of denouncing capitalism, Castro literally wraps himself in a capitalist brand, one of the world's most recognizable logo, the three stripes of Adidas. Did he ever talk about that?
I'm not certain that he ever talked about that, but one thing you can say, it is ironic. There is another side to the revolution, which is the wealth that especially opponents would point to and say that Fidel Castro has amassed. Obviously, that's not what the Cuban authorities would say. They would say he did it all for the people.
Did Fidel really meet with the Pope? Was he in a blue tracksuit when he met the Pope?
He was in the tracksuit when he met the Pope.
I believe it was.
Yeah, absolutely true. It's not fake news. It's not. We're not making it up. The pictures are there. You can look them up. Fidel Castro met the Pope in a tracksuit. And I don't have the picture in front of me, but I believe it may have actually been the one that's got F. Castro on it with the national emblem on it, the one that the athletes would have worn.
I suspect some Cuban Americans in Miami would wear an F. Castro jacket, but that has a different meaning.
I think it might. I think it really. Yes, absolutely.
Emilio, one serious question for you. You tweeted that Cuban authorities are reportedly clamping down on dissidents in the wake of Fidel Castro's death. What have you heard?
One dissident in particular is the Cuban artist El Sexto. He goes by that name. He's a graffiti artist. Mm. He's been in trouble with the authorities before. And soon after Fidel Castro died, he took to the streets and carried out, a bit like Banksy, putting up a work of art, graffiti on a building. Well, he did it at the Habana Libre Hotel, which is quite a symbolic building. It used to be the Havana Hilton before the revolution. And he put along the wall of it, he scrawled, "Se fue," which means he's gone. That's all he wrote. And that was enough, apparently, to land him in jail. And
that alone.
According, that alone, yes, landed him in jail because a lot of the dissidents had been warned, visited by the authorities, and told to kind of keep a low profile during this period. And they meant it. And when he did that, he was dragged in by the authorities, perhaps even suffered some kind of abuse at the hands of the police, and was then jailed. I haven't been able to find out whether he's been released from jail.
My colleague, Emilio San Pedro, the BBC's America's editor. Thank you very much, Emilio.
Thank you.
By the way, we have a selection of Castro's tracksuits for your viewing pleasure at PRI.org. This is The World.
The World is brought to you by PRI with help from TIAA. Whether it's investing, advice, banking, or retirement, TIAA is dedicated to helping those who teach, heal, and serve others achieve a lifetime of financial well-being. More at TIAA.org.
I'm Marco Werman. Hate crimes are on the rise in the U.S., and this activist wants more people to pay attention.
The Muslim woman who was pushed down the stairs of a New York City subway, the Latino children who were told they shouldn't come to school anymore because they're going to be deported soon. That is the story that'll carry the day.
That's still coming up here on The World. I'm Marco Werman with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston.
And I'm Rupa Shenoy, host of The World's Otherhood podcast.
Hey, Rupa. I'm actually going to take a break and turn things over to you right now, because in the next few minutes of the show, we're going to tackle precisely the kind of issues you often explore on Otherhood.
Thank you, Marco. So here's an alarming fact. Since the election, federal and state agencies have reported a spike in the number of hate crimes. This past weekend, for example, an off-duty New York City police officer who was wearing a hijab reported a confrontation with a man on the street. The man threatened to cut her throat. And here's another incident where the threat was delivered on the phone. Our colleagues at the BBC spoke to a Muslim American man in Maine whose family was targeted by an abusive caller.
Right after Donald Trump was in Lewiston, Maine, I got this call at that time.
I can't wait till Trump is president. We're going to round you subhumans up and send you on your way.
There are people fighting back against the rise in hate crimes, like Amardeep Singh. He's with the Open Society Foundations, a nonprofit created by billionaire George Soros, who's a Holocaust survivor and immigrant himself. 3 weeks ago, Soros pledged $10 million to fight the rise in hate crimes. Singh is working on how to get that money to people who can do the most with it. He says one goal is to support efforts to collect more data. Singh says the federal government has been undercounting the number of hate incidents.
If you look at their very recent, it just was released a few weeks ago, hate crimes report, you would see that in Mississippi and Alabama, there were hardly any hate crimes, whereas New York would seem to indicate that it's a hotbed for hate incident activity. And that's because the federal government doesn't require jurisdictions to report whether there were any hate crimes in their jurisdiction. So you really have a skewed view of what's happening in the country. So in place of the federal government, in part because they're just failing in this regard, we're going to be supporting community groups to not only collect incidents, which they already do, but most importantly, aggregate them across communities so that Latino, Black, Muslim, Arab, South Asian, transgender, LGBTQ folks are collecting data collectively, but then also aggregating it and making that information public and searchable. That has never been done before, but this moment allows for it because basically anyone who's not sort of straight, white, male has been a target.
There's a lot of pushback, right, from people who say that we're ignoring crimes against white people or that people are blowing this out of proportion or it's a political ploy or people are just being dramatic and oversensitive. Mm-hmm. How would you respond to that?
I think it's important that in the place of government's failure or inability to understand what's happening, that you have community groups document what's happening. And at the end of the day, people will interpret that as they will. But it's incumbent upon us when government isn't there for us, you know, on this issue to at least collect the information and let people interpret it as they see. Some people say, oh, there have been 4,000 hate incidents over the past year. That's not a big deal. Others will say there have been 4,000, and that's a really big deal. But I think our objective really is getting that information out there so that people can grapple with it.
Do you seek to persuade those people? Do you think hard information will persuade some of those people?
I think it's difficult to move society's attention to a problem unless it's documented. It's going to be difficult to persuade local law enforcement that they need to be aware that Muslim women, for example, who wear the hijab are particularly vulnerable to hate violence and hate incidents unless you document that that's happening with real live examples and real people who can speak to the problem, not just sort of talking heads or experts.
When you see an incident and it's happening and you're there, what do you do? What do you want people to do in that moment?
We don't have advice as in terms of what people should do in the moment. I will say, though, from my past experience working at a community-based organization, we always tell people to first just get to safety, make sure that they're personally safe if some sort of violent or aggressive incident is occurring. Second, it's very important to report to authorities as soon as you possibly can if you see something or experiencing something hateful or violent. Third, consider reporting what's happened to a community-based organization. In the United States, we have a very strong civil society. We have very strong community-based organizations that understand what the law requires. And reporting to them is a way of perhaps achieving a measure of justice if government institutions fail.
There are some people on the right especially who are suspicious of George Soros and say has used his money to influence politics. Are you worried that that's going to cast a light on the data you're collecting and people won't see it as solid information for that reason?
I have a lot of faith that once people see the stories of, for example, the Muslim woman who was pushed down the stairs of a New York City subway, which actually happened over the past week, hear the story of the transgender activist in Appalachia who's being harassed post-election, hears about the Latino children who are told they shouldn't come to school anymore because they're going to be deported soon, that is the story that'll carry the day.
It almost sounds like part of this project is to inspire hope.
I would say so. Again, you know, before I was at the Open Society Foundations, I co-founded and led the Sikh Coalition, the nation's largest Sikh civil rights organization. And, you know, my experience was that where we were able to present information in a way that people understood, people responded positively, meaning there is hope out there. I haven't given up, nor has the Open Society Foundations, in my belief.
Amradeep Singh with the Open Society Foundations, thanks so much for joining us. I really appreciate your time.
Thank you.
The fight against hate crimes gets back to identities and which hyphenated identities are accepted in the Western world, which is actually a good segue to a song that Marco has been wanting to share here on the show.
Yeah, that's right, Rupa. Rupa Shenoy there, host of our Otherhood podcast. And that song I want to share now, it's about feeling out of place because of identity.
I've been low, I've been high, I've been sold all my life, I've got nothing.
This is British Ugandan soul singer Michael Kiwanuka, a track from his latest album. This is Black Man in a White World.
I'm a black man in a white world, I'm a black man in a white world. I feel like I've been here before, I feel that now.
You know, with everything that's going on in the world, it's got to be a pretty interesting time to be involved in Islamic studies, which can be done at a number of American colleges or universities. But there was a time when Islamic studies were not a part of the U.S. academic menu. That all changed with a man named Philip Hitti. His story goes back to the early 20th century. Hitti was born in Lebanon in a farming village. And when he was a kid, his dad sent him and his brother on an errand on a donkey.
Philip's father said, "Don't get on the donkey. Don't play around on the donkey." And so, of course, as two young boys might do, once they got out of their father's line of sight, they started riding the donkey.
Evan Taparata there. He's a PhD candidate at the University of Minnesota. He wrote about Hitti for our website, PRI.org. Riding that donkey turned out not to be a good idea. Hitti fell down, broke his arm, a compound fracture, no less. After that injury, Hitti's family decided that their son wouldn't be successful in life if he stayed in that village. Things would be better if he went abroad to study, they thought. And so they sent him off to America.
He arrives to the United States in about 1913. And by that time, he had done some schooling back in Lebanon. And he actually came to the U.S. to pursue his Ph.D. And he did that at Columbia. Columbia University. The major area that he studied in at Columbia was Semitic languages. And he studied Hebrew, Assyrian, Babylonian. And after receiving his doctorate, he ended up staying in the United States for several years, not necessarily by choice. I mean, this was right during the World War I years, and it was quite difficult. It would have been quite difficult for him to return. So he stayed and did some teaching. And it was in that time when he realized that there really was a lack of coverage of Islamic and Arabic people in higher education curriculum in the United States.
I'm curious, Philip Hitti, that first name, that's obviously not Muslim. Was he Muslim himself?
Philip, and this is a really interesting part of the story, is that no, Philip himself was not Muslim. Philip was Christian, actually.
So what motivated him?
Well, first, Marco, I should say, I don't want to, you know, presume that I could speak for Philip. What I can say is that as a Christian, Philip noted that there were many similarities between Christian people, between Muslims, between Jews, and he believed that it was more important to highlight the connections and the parallels between these people and their religious beliefs rather than highlight the differences between them.
So what were some of the courses in Islam that Ahiti introduced, and where were they taught and how were they received?
Well, so first, Philip noted that when he first started teaching at Princeton University, he was hired to come on as kind of a specialist in the Arab world and the Near East is how they termed it in those days. Philip noticed that if there were courses at Princeton at that time that talked about Arabic people or Islamic people, Muslims, that they focused more so on the relationship of Islam to Christianity or to Judaism. And he thought it was really important to highlight that connection and that relationship, certainly. But he also wanted to introduce courses that taught students about Islam for Islam's sake. And so he made that his mission in the courses that he designed and offered while at Princeton.
So I'm curious, Evan, for students who are in Islamic studies today around the country, what would you tell them is the most important part of Philip Hiti's legacy?
I think there are a few lessons here. It took Philip many years, actually, to get this program of Near Eastern studies and Islamic and Arabic studies off the ground. And I think that it's a story that reminds us the struggle to make sure that curriculum in the United States that speaks to the experiences and histories and cultures of diverse peoples is this is an ongoing struggle. Philip believed that recognizing that the history of Islamic people was not some isolated field of study. He believed it was that the experience and history of Muslims is very much integral to the history and experiences and cultures of people all over the world, regardless of their religion. And yes, now today more than ever, I think this is a lesson that students of Islamic studies would certainly benefit from remembering. But I think we all can benefit from remembering that right now.
Evan Taparata, PhD candidate at the University of Minnesota. Thanks very much for your time.
Thanks so much, Marco.
We go now to China. You know the deal, a big place with 1.3 billion people. That means a lot of different cuisines. So to write a cookbook called China, the Cookbook, that's a pretty bold move. And that's what Kay Lum Chan and his wife have done. Chan says the two of them traveled around China to sample lots of different dishes. Here's Chan recalling one memorable meal they had in Mongolia.
They served dinner on a wooden board with a whole lamb, which has been boiled. They used a sheep called the fat tail sheep with a big, big tail. It's just a big piece of fat. And when they serve the lamb, the piece of fat is separated and put on top of the lamb. Okay, so you see this big glob of fat that sits on top of a boiled lamb. And the host would take a knife. He would cut out a strip of this fat, put it on his palm, and serve it to the guest of honor, which in that particular day was me. I had to receive that piece of fat. It's about, I would say, about 4 inches long and about an inch wide, a piece of fat. I had to receive it on the palm of my hand and sort of suck it in one breath. Now, that was the way they do it. You have to do it as the guest of honor, and everybody that follows you will have to do the same thing until everybody is served. Now, my friend next to me did have some trouble doing that. Now, probably psychologically than anything else, because he went down halfway. So it took him an additional try. But anyway, it was very funny. That was one of the experiences as we go around the country, sampling different food from different cultures. China is not just Sichuanese or Cantonese food. We've got 30-some plus regions, and if you count sub-regions, it's even more. China is really diversity itself. Wherever you go, you find this food different. But, and yet you still recognize it as Chinese food. We are the beneficiaries of thousands of years of development, and we're very fortunate, and us as Chinese are very lucky to have such a rich heritage to write from. The key thing to remember, Chinese food is about sharing. We hate to eat alone. Chinese don't like it. This is probably the most important thing. No matter where you go in China, all the food is shared. If you go to Mongolia, they share a lamb. If you go to Canton, they share a dish of vegetables. Everything is shared. It is hard to cook for one in China, in Chinese cooking. You just don't do a portion of one. You share amongst families, you share amongst friends, and it really contributes to harmony. So we think a great deal of food, not just because of the pleasure of eating, but for the pleasure of company. And this is true wherever you go in China.
Kay Lum Chan is the co-author of China, the Cookbook. He spoke with producer Alex Galifant. I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. Disabled people face challenges everywhere, but in some countries they're still treated as social outcasts. One young man from Afghanistan is on a quest to change that. He now lives here in the U.S. Christina Quinn went to meet him at his home in Watertown, Massachusetts, not too far from our studios here in Boston.
Hi, Mohammed?
Yeah. Hi, Christina.
Mohammed Saeed is unstoppable. At the age of 19, he's already an inventor and entrepreneur. One half of his business, called RimPower, is providing assistive technologies. The other half is a comic book series centered around the hero, Wheelchair Man.
So for me, my goal is to help people in wheelchair, both psychologically and physically. The world where every wheelchair user is empowered rather than disabled.
Mohammed, who prefers to go by Mo, knows firsthand what that's all about. When he was 5 years old, he suffered a traumatic spinal cord injury when his home back in Afghanistan was bombed. This happened only days after he lost his mother to cancer. And if things couldn't get any worse, his father took him to a hospital in Kabul and never returned.
Basically, I was on my own.
Mo spent 7 years in a trauma hospital because he had nowhere else to go, and he had to keep himself alive. So he became a hustler, wheeling around the hospital, repairing staffers' cell phones, and taking pictures for photo IDs. He even taught himself English by listening to the BBC and charged for translation.
He was the uncertainty that if this hospital closed, you have no place to go. So you gotta have enough savings. You gotta act, you know, like you are no different than anybody who lives here. I think I just never gave up.
He never gave up, even when the hospital staff had to evacuate, leaving him alone with just a few hospital guards.
The first month was really tough for me. I missed people because, you know, I would interact with patients, with nurses, with doctors. And all of a sudden, there was a place like a ghost town, and I was the only living soul in it.
His luck would change 6 months later when Maria Pia Sanchez, an American nurse working in Afghanistan, came looking for him. A doctor who knew Mo asked her to check on him.
So we stopped by the hospital where he had been living to see if there was anyone there and if they might know where he was. So my search was actually quite easy because it turned out he was still living there, just he and a couple of guards and a cleaner.
What was that like when you came in and you found him?
Even though he was so young, he was entrusted with many things in the hospital that the older staff were not. I mean, he was given the keys to the pharmacy when they had to leave quickly because they trusted him to keep all that stuff safe. And he was an amazing kid from everything that I had heard. So in a way, it didn't surprise me.
So Maria ended up adopting Mo. And 2 years later, he moved to the U.S. with $600 of his earnings in his pocket, as he likes to point out. But this new life in the suburbs of Boston, one without constant worry of being kicked out of the hospital, a life with a mother who cooks and takes care of you, this new normal didn't mean Mo would rest on his laurels.
Even though that life has ended for me, you know, I have a place where I live here, you know, you would never feel certain.
Yeah.
That, you know, those are the kind of things that stays with you, but what define us as humans is that some of us don't give in.
And his idea of not giving in started to shift when he learned about Mahatma Gandhi. It was his introduction to using nonviolence as a weapon, and the whole concept blew his mind.
Before learning about Gandhi, my role models were warlords, and I would say, I wish I had my legs so I could go and kill these bastards, you know, the Taliban.
Those warlords were replaced with Gandhi, Martin Luther King Jr., and Nelson Mandela. But in the pantheon of heroes, there was still a piece missing. And it wasn't until Mo attended Comic-Con in Boston a couple years ago that everything came into full focus.
Most superheroes, you know, that comes out, it's like all about action and violence, and at the end everything is destroyed and the hero becomes a hero because he destroyed everything. It's like, what is the message you're sending to young kids?
There's a bit of a swagger to Mo. His thick black eyebrows frame these eyes that have a playful gleam. You can't help but think that he is always one step ahead of you. And maybe he is.
So in this Boston Comic-Con that we were there, why there is nobody representing the wheelchair community? Why isn't there a wheelchair superhero who is wheeling around here?
So he set out to make Wheelchair Man, an Afghan-American superhero who, upon making eye contact, shows a would-be criminal the consequences of his actions before he commits them. That's his power. Throw in a wheelchair that can travel at warp speed with amphibious capabilities, and you've got yourself a pretty badass comic book hero. But what makes Wheelchair Man truly unique is that he's based on a true story, Mo's story.
In Afghanistan, we don't have superheroes, so this is a first, especially a first that's based on an Afghan-American. So I think a lot of kids in Afghanistan, especially when they read this and they know about this story, it will really impact them.
With another 19-year-old, this might just be a pipe dream, but it's clear Mo is going to make it happen. He's already completed a draft of the first edition of Wheelchair Man. His goal is to get copies of it into hospitals and rehab centers all over the world. He also has plans to build out a franchise that includes characters Captain Afghanistan, Wheelchair Boy, and Wheelchair Girl.
So we are going downstairs to the workshop to show how, you know, Wheelchair Man's wheelchair is coming along, because I'm building a full scale.
And if his basement workshop is any indication, his plan doesn't stop there. He's already thinking about movies and video games.
So this is, that's a green screen.
You painted the green screen?
Yeah. So this will be a full-scale prototype wheelchair of Wheelchair Man, which you see the mini model over there.
Mm-hmm. So you got all kinds of pulleys and...
I mean, I tell you, I don't want to scare Marvel, but if we have the right investors and the right amount of money, we could compete. We have original ideas, original superheroes. It's very different. Some people say different is bad, but in this time and in the situation we are now, my characters, I mean, everybody around the world need hope. Everybody want peace. And everybody around the world can relate to them.
What's the tagline?
Hope is on the way. And here is a little hint, though. Hope is on the way is something very important in the Wheelchair Man book. It could be the code. Who knows? Maybe not.
Don't give too many secrets away.
I have to wait.
For The World, Christina Quinn, Watertown, Massachusetts.
Hope is on the way. Nice note to end on. From the Nan and Bill Harris Studios at WGBH in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. Back with you tomorrow.
PRI. Public Radio International.